All right, let's turn to the questions from the audience. What steps should the USA take to ensure US elections are safe and credible from interference from foreign nations? What steps are being taken, and do you worry about the Russians and the Chinese trying to interfere in future elections? Nick?
We should definitely worry that the Russians and the Chinese and maybe the Iranians and North Koreans, they all have cyber capacity, could try to infiltrate our elections. We know the Russians did. Our intelligence community has a consensus on that in 2016. And we know they're going to try again, because at least I don't believe that we've mounted a sufficient defense. And so it's a question of the federal government working with the 50 states, the electoral commissions in the 50 states, to raise our defenses. It's even broader than the United States, because in 2017, there's a lot of evidence that the Russians infiltrated the Dutch, French, and German elections. Putin's objectives are to cut the United States down to size. He can no longer contend with the United States military. We're stronger in every conventional sense. So he's turned to these asymmetric means that Admiral McRaven talked about, and one of them is weakening our democracy, making us doubt the efficacy of our elections, making us wonder if every vote's been counted, flooding Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, social media with millions of bits of false information to turn us against each other at a fractious time. And so our federal government can't do everything, but it has a capacity to coordinate the states and to help the states raise their defenses. And as I said to the students in our earlier program, I'm no longer in government, but I assume our government's doing everything we can to hit back in the cyber war as well, because I think that's the only language that Putin understands. He's 20 years in power. He's very self-confident, and he's got a lot of sophistication. When he gets hit, then he'll understand there's a price to pay for doing what he's trying to do to us.
John.
When you think about this issue against our country, it's just like military threat or defense of the nation. You have the away game, as I characterize it, fought by the Department of Defense, CIA, people like that overseas, and you have the home game, just as important, maybe more important these days. And within the Department of Homeland Security, you don't hear about it very much, but they are tasked to protect all government networks inside the United States, and anyone that wants to voluntarily be part of it to help protect, whether it's Microsoft, and it is an amazing collaboration that DHS does in fact have with companies large and small. Obviously the .gov networks are their task to protect, but the Secretary of Homeland Security, it started a bit when I was there, but Secretary Nielsen, in her kind of day job, you know her more from the immigration issues, but she was out and about and managed to get all of the 50 states signed up to cooperate voluntarily to let DHS help protect their nets. The good news is about our election process, it's so decentralized. Every state, not the federal government, every state runs their own, and in fact, in many cases, counties run their own, and in many cases, cities. So it's a very, very decentralized, so hard to attack from a cyber point of view. Not impossible, but hard to attack. I think the larger threat, as Nick points out, is just the massive amounts of disinformation that comes through all of these various social media. And I think, you know, what I learned about when there were only newspapers and TV, people would say, don't believe everything you read in a newspaper or watch on TV. I think that is in spades, you should take that advice about internet and social media, because that's where I think that they'll focus on to try to convince people that this election was tampered with, or this individual candidate has got some baggage or whatever. So I think as citizens, we have to redouble, triple, quadruple our efforts to really get to know the issues. An informed citizenry cannot be duped, and I think that's, we have to work harder at it.
Question on alliances. Obviously, the NATO alliance was a strong alliance for the United States in dealing with Russia, but there are a number flashpoints in the world that will demand other alliances as well. What do you believe is the future of the United States in developing alliances that we need for our national security? Nick?
Well, NATO's been successful, and it's not just yesterday's story, it's tomorrow's story, because they were with us in the coalition against the Islamic State Caliphate, they've been with us in Afghanistan, and they're with us in containing Putin. We have our East Asian allies, critical for the biggest challenge we're going to face, especially the students here, and that is how do we work with China and yet not be dominated by China? Japan, South Korea, and Australia are treaty allies of the United States. The Philippines and Thailand are defense partners. India, I think, is one of the best things we've done on a bipartisan basis. President Bush, President Clinton, President Bush, President Obama, President Trump have all tried to build a big relationship with India. India is the world's largest democracy. It has the same problem with China that we do. So that's coalition building. And I think we're pretty good at this. I mean, as you served presidents, we all have. Our presidents are coalition builders, sometimes with these permanent alliances, sometimes creating temporary coalitions. And we have, because of our strength and because people believe in us, we have the capacity to create those coalitions. We should never want to work alone. And as I told the students today on 9/11, when we were hit very hard, I was at NATO. The allies came to us and said, we want to invoke Article 5. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. The next morning we did. And when I called the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, to receive the president's permission that we would initiate this because it was going to war together, she said to me, and I'll never forget it, she said, it's good to have friends in the world. And that was your opening, Mr. Secretary, your opening comment tonight. We don't want to live alone. We're not alone. We have this tremendous attractiveness to the rest of the world because we're a democracy and we're fair-minded, and we should play on that strength.
Let me ask our military guys here. NATO was a very important alliance both in Iraq and Afghanistan. What was it like fighting alongside our allies? I mean, was it effective? Was it tough? I mean, what?
Oh, it was fabulous. I will tell you, they are great soldiers. The NATO alliance, and I ran the NATO Special Operations Force. And then when I was in Afghanistan, I had the NATO soldiers working with me there. They were just as committed, just as brave, just as courageous, and sacrificed proportionally almost as much when you take a look at the losses, certainly in Afghanistan. Their cultures were fun because when you're working in a group, it's almost like the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps times 10. Because you know, I think we had maybe 19 nations somewhere, and again, that was not just NATO, but it was the Australians and the Swedes and friends of NATO. But I'll go back to something Nick said. They came to help us in Afghanistan, I would contend, not because of a piece of paper that said Article 5. They came because we helped rebuild Europe. We helped rebuild Japan after World War II. We have great friends around the world because of American leadership and American values. And I tell you, our future won't matter so much about the alliances on paper. It will matter about the friendships we develop president to president and citizen to citizen across the world. Because if you think what happens in a mud hut in Yemen doesn't affect the farmers in Iowa, you're mistaken. If you think what happens in Syria doesn't bother the people in California, you're mistaken. The world is so connected today, we can't get away from those problems. We shouldn't try to get away from those problems, but the only way we're going to be able to deal with them is to have friends and allies in the region that can help us.
John, thank you. General Kelly, did you have reservations about who received security clearances?
Yes, John, did you?
Let me just put it this way. When you come out of particularly the military or the intelligence community, security clearances, the handling of classified material, it's a religion. It's in your DNA. And every single person understands, you know, what the clearance is, how to handle classified material. I would just say that when a new team comes into the White House, and remember, on the 19th of January, the day before inauguration, the people that are working at the White House, in this case, the Obama administration, had been there 2, 3, 4, 5 years doing their job. The next day, they didn't come to work. No one did. And then on the 21st, the day after the inauguration, the new group, in this case, the Trump team, gets there. And it's the good news is there's an awful lot of, you know, career people that work at the White House. These are really, you know, very, very capable career servants that are there administration after administration. But the point is that the new team just didn't have the same sense of how important clearances was and that kind of thing. So when I got there, and you probably read about it, I started to tighten it up. There were no really bad people in this. It was just that in many cases, they just didn't know. Again, it's a religion with me. It wasn't with them. And we tightened it up. And some people, we had to drop them down in the security clearance from one level to another until their background investigations were complete. We looked at how, you know, you're not supposed to have a high clearance if you don't need it. So we permanently reduced people that simply didn't need a very, very high level. And then we trained everyone in terms of how to handle and protect classified material. So yes, I had, but we fixed it, and it's much better for the effort.
All right. North Korea. We've been through two summits between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. There is now talk of a third summit, and yet our intelligence assessment is that North Korea will not give up their nuclear arms because it threatens their regime. What good is having another summit if it isn't going to produce denuclearization? Nick?
I would not advise a third summit. As I said before, I think President Trump was right to go to Singapore and Hanoi to take the measure of Kim Jong-un. We've learned a lot about him, but he's not given up anything. And he's not testing his nuclear weapons, which is positive. He hasn't succeeded in developing an ICBM that can hit, that can reach the atmosphere and reentry to hit California or Florida or Massachusetts, thank goodness. And that should be our central concern. But he's going to hold on to those nuclear weapons. And we have not created a negotiation where there's enough pressure on him right now to induce him to give up anything else. So our two weapons, our two points of leverage were these guys. It was the ability to say, if you don't cooperate with us, we have military options, although the options were very difficult, and we talked about that today. The second was more important, economic sanctions. We had China, Japan, South Korea, India, the European Union, Russia, and the United States all sanctioning North Korea. I think that's what drove him to the negotiating table last year. But when the president came back from Singapore, the president announced by tweet from Air Force One on the ground in Washington, the North Korean nuclear problem's been resolved. It hadn't been resolved. What's happened since? China and Russia have started trading again. South Korea wants to make peace. So the sanctions have been diminished. There's no pressure. I think it'd be a waste of the president's credibility. You don't want to see our president fail. We should want President Trump to succeed here. I'd send in some of the more, not junior people, but our ambassadorial level negotiators. We have a very good person named Steve Biegun. A general knows him well. He's hard-nosed. I'd let Steve and Secretary Pompeo take the lead from here.
Okay, let's, interesting question here. How is climate change impacting military decisions and deployment currently? How will the military prepare for dealing with escalating climate-based crises with an administration that has publicly denounced and stated that climate change is not real? Bill?
Well, what I do know is that, again, we talked about the military planning process, and I will tell you, a couple times a year, when I was part of the senior leader conference with General Kelly, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we would go down to Quantico, and we would get in the gymnasium, and we would lay out all the orders of battle, and we would war game our strategy as we began to build the budget to make recommendations to the president and the Congress on the shape of the military to come. the military today, as they think about what issues are going to affect the development of the military, certainly think about climate change. They realize that climate change is affecting everything from natural disasters, which means that the military will have to be pulled away in order to support natural disasters. They know that the rising sea levels will at some point in time affect freedom of navigation in certain areas. They understand that the melting ice caps mean that the Russians will have more access to the Arctic. So all of these things come into the thought process that the military puts into their overall military strategy. So I won't say irrespective of whatever the administration's position is, but the military knows they have to think about these issues in order to build the best military to propose to the President and the Congress.
I just really a quick vignette about the planning, the way the military plans. I mean, it's a culture of planning. I can remember when I worked for Secretary Panetta in the first few weeks I worked for him, almost every day there'd be some crisis on TV, and I'd bring someone up from the Joint Staff, usually a one-star, two-star, and I wanted them to get to meet the Secretary as well. And they'd come up and give him a quick thumbnail brief on whatever the issue was. And of course, they always referenced the plan that we had for just such an eventuality. And I mean, this was every day. So after a very short period of time, the Secretary said, "You know, Kelly, do we have a plan for like?" I mean, is that all they do down there is plan? Is there a plan for everything? I said, Mr. Secretary, it's a culture. They look at every conceivable problem before it's a problem and develop a plan to address the problem. Something in the can, ready to go. I said, there is actually a plan if South Carolina invades North Dakota. I mean, we got a plan.
Really?
We got a plan for everything. And that's a good thing because the military and the military staffs don't wait to be told what to do. The combatant commanders know their zone so well. They're so deep and so broad, and they're developing their own plans and feeding those plans up to Washington. So when something does happen, almost every time you pull probably a 70% solution off the shelf, fill in the blanks, and there's a plan, and not just a warfighting plan. It could be responsive natural disasters, you know, this kind of thing, so.
South Carolina is not planning on.
As far as we know.
But if they do.
But there's a plan.
John Kelly, what are your concerns about President Trump appointing secretaries on an acting basis?
First of all, the way it's supposed to work, the way it does work, is the Senate is supposed to get a crack at every person that's going to be in a Senate-confirmed position, which is a lot of people. And it's the advice and consent issue, and it's part of the Constitution and part of our laws and the part of the way we do business. And so when you propose someone to be the Secretary of Defense, Homeland Security, whatever, they have to go up before Congress. They're vetted, background investigations completed. And then they go up and have a hearing and basically get grilled by the Congress, both sides of the aisle, of course. And then there's a vote. And typically, in my case, actually, it was 88 votes, yes. I mean, you don't hear that anymore because of the temperature in Washington. Almost all the votes now are on political basis. But the point is, if you have an acting, the institution, let's talk about the Department of Defense for a second, or for that matter, DHS. When there's an acting, everyone in the organization knows that person's temporary. By law, that person can't stay in the job indefinitely, by law. So eventually, someone has to be nominated. It might be that acting person. But in the meantime, the institution that they're in charge of, it coasts a little bit because everyone knows, the bureaucracy knows, that person is only going to be there temporarily, and the next person who is actually confirmed may or may not agree with the work. So it just kind of is complicating for the professionals that work inside the organization. And then the Congress, the Senate in particular, they want their shot at a person, and it's supposed to be that someone gets nominated, they go up for confirmation, they're voted on by the committee and then by the of jurisdiction and then the entire Senate. And if that's not working, that's not the way it's supposed to be. But we do have a lot of actings right now, and I think the president would be, I mean, if I was still there, certainly I would be pressing to get people nominated and get the process done. And in the Senate, and this is in the open press, I mean, the Senate is getting more and more agitated, both sides of the aisle, because of the fact that the confirmation, yeah. You know, they want the process to work and it should work.
Yeah. Bill, what happens if we withdraw our forces from Afghanistan? What is the future of that country?
Well, I'm not optimistic, frankly, about the future of Afghanistan if we withdraw. Now, right now we have negotiations going on between one of our great diplomats, Zal Khalilzad, and the Taliban, trying to, I think, broker a peace agreement. And then the thinking is, and we'll bring in the Afghans. My concern with the Taliban is they are an unreliable partner in terms of a negotiation. We have done, as painful as it has been over the last 18 years, I think we've done a lot of good things in Afghanistan. We've certainly opened up education for women. We've ensured the safety and security of the large cities from Kandahar to Mosul. To Kabul, to Mazar Sharif, to Herat. Although candidly, the outlying areas are still heavy Taliban. If we broker a peace with the Taliban and we come out of Afghanistan, I really do fear for the long-term survival of the government in Kabul. And more importantly, I fear for the young women that are there that, again, we have put in a position to be successful, to go to school. Under the Taliban, I think all that will go away. So I'm hoping we can find some other solution. If it was up to Bill McRaven, we would stay there for as long as it takes to make Afghanistan viable. And I realize that means more sacrifice and more money, but I think it's the right thing to do. I get concerned when we spend time with an ally, whether it is the Kurds or the Iraqis or the South Vietnamese, and then we leave, and then the governments fall apart and entire lives and civilizations are changed. I think we have an obligation, as tough as that has been, I think we have an obligation to continue to help the Afghans as best we can.
Okay, Nick, this is probably one for you. Is there any hope for a Middle East peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, or has any hope been lost?
I wish I could say there's hope. I mean, a student asked this question this afternoon and said, will there ever be peace? We have to hope there's going to be peace. Jimmy Carter was able to negotiate a peace between Egypt and Israel. Bill Clinton was able to bring peace to both Bosnia and Kosovo, so it can happen. But it's been 70 years, and both neither side wants peace. The Palestinians are divided. Abu Mazen, the relatively more moderate leader of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, is aging. A lot of charges of corruption. He doesn't get along with Hamas, which is a violent terrorist group, and doesn't want peace with Israel, wants to destroy Israel. So the Palestinians are divided. The Israelis very much divided. Even with the recent re-election of Prime Minister Netanyahu, he doesn't appear to want to be the prime minister who agrees to establish a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, divide Jerusalem, give the Palestinians a capital in East Jerusalem. He's very much in league politically right now with the settler movement, the right-wing settler movement in the West Bank and in the Golan Heights. And so it just isn't there. But I think for the United States, this is a tough choice, because even if we think analytically there's no chance for peace in the next 2 years, and there really isn't, we're going to have to continue to play the arbiter, buffer, umpire role, because what we've learned about this situation, I served out there when I was a young officer in the Palestinian region, in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, left to their own devices, there will be terrorism, there'll be rocket wars, and nothing good's going to happen. So you need American negotiators to be working this issue so that when political change comes in both these communities, maybe you can capitalize on it, but it's a very difficult time. And I would say this, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama, all of our presidents, both parties, felt it was very important that while we're Israel's closest friend and supporter, We will support the rights of the Palestinian people for a just future. And since Bill Clinton, we support the right of the Palestinians to their own state. And President Trump has not taken that position. He's entirely in the Israeli camp. He has cut off U.S. aid to the Palestinian refugees. He has moved our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's declared Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. None of our presidents had done this because you want to be an effective arbiter, and I think he's deprived us of that station.
Is the two-state solution gone?
You know, I hope not. And what we mean by that is that all of us, since Lyndon Johnson, have believed that the land of Israel, the land of Palestine, historically, I should say, has to be divided between the Palestinians and the Israelis. A lot of Palestinians believe that a one-state solution is the way forward. That's through the gun, to overwhelm Israel and to defeat it, or by exceeding Israel in population, outvoting them. A lot of Israelis on the right of the political spectrum want a one-state solution. We can never deal with the Palestinians. We can triumph and unite the land of Israel without them. Both of those one-state solutions are recipes for violence. And so as Americans, I think we've got to be the party arguing for a two-state solution, and we've got to be an arbiter, and we've got to try to have links to both sides of this conflict, not just one.
John, what was it like to be a tough Marine chief of staff with a president who doesn't accept any discipline?
It was heaven on earth. just kind of a real primer. The chief of staff of any organization, the primary thing that person's supposed to do is obviously organize the staff. There's always a principal, whether it's a general, an admiral, or a president. And so when I got to the White House, and I was drafted. I mean, the president called me one day and said, I need you to come and be the chief of staff. I was pretty happy where I was. But, you know, when the president calls, just like when he asked me to be Homeland Security, I'm a man of serving the country. And even though I never wanted to work another day in my life after 45 years in the Marine Corps, I took it on. So I get to the White House, and there was no process. There was no staff functioning as anything remotely close to what you'd see on, say, a military staff or on any staff. So the first thing I put in place was that we would staff the president. And so for every issue that came up, whether it was a pop-up issue like, you know, Assad using chemical weapons against his people, or something more long-term like developing a tax reform package or something like that, we got the right people in, started the process, started to put together and develop the policy, and then eventually took that to the president and had a series of meetings with him from, you know, very disparate. I mean, depending on what the issue was, we had pastors of small black churches, we had evangelical leaders, we had always members of Congress would come. These are various, on various, we had leaders from the gay community come in. I mean, it was really industrialist union leaders on some of the issues that we were bringing to the president. And so we just feed the president as much information as it takes so he can then make an informed decision. When he'd make his decision, then people like me, I'm actually responsible for it, to then implement that. So he makes the decision, and then you get the entire government going in the right direction. So while I was there, he accepted that process, and for the most part, it worked. It was pretty consistent. But he is a man of you know, like all of us, has his own strong opinions on things. But in every case that while I was there for 18 months, in every case we stuck to this process, and he made decisions. You may disagree with his decisions. You may dislike him personally, or maybe you voted for him, but the point is, he's the president of the United States, and if he fails or makes a mistake, it impacts every one of us, Democrat, Republican, man, woman, gay, straight, and he, as the president of the United States, deserves the best servicing of his staff that anyone can give him, and I gave him that for 18 months.
Thank you. He's intuitively a New York developer. Has he been able to adjust from being a developer in New York to being president of the United States?
As a developer, you know, one of the things I've been fairly close to two presidents. And I watched Mr. Obama when we were on active duty, and so, you know, the frustration level I think with all presidents when they come in is, and this gets to the checks and balances. And God, if I ever doubted why we had checks and balances, I mean, those guys that wrote the Constitution were really smart. Because you're the candidate, you've won, you come in and you want to make the changes that you promised the American society, the voters. You want to do that, and so you're all excited about it, and you hit, you know, squarely, the first problem you have is the bureaucracy does not work that it works, and there's tens of thousands of really great Americans that work very hard in those bureaucracies, but there's ways that the bureaucracies operate as defined by law, so quick decisions are really not possible. They are if you have like a 9/11 or, you know, or an attack on Pearl Harbor, something like that. But the rest of the way the government works is relatively slow, relatively ponderous. It appeals, actually, for input from the voters. So every president is frustrated when he gets into the office because he just doesn't have the powers that maybe he thought he had. So in the case of President Trump, I mean, in every president, my role was when he wanted to do something to back to the process, to start the process and find out what's within the realm of the doable. And for immediate issues would be, I got to get the lawyers down here, sir. I don't know if you have the authority to do that, so let's get the lawyers down here. Sometimes he did have the authority and we'd go do it. And in other cases, you don't have the authority, you would have to go to Congress. And so when you're a man of action or a woman of action someday in the Oval Office, and you hit right up against this ponderous, slow checks and balances thing.
You can always pardon somebody.
Yeah. You said that.
Let me ask you. We've got about 3 minutes left. I really want you to look at the time between now and the next 5 years and. Tell me whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about the future of this country. Bill?
I'm optimistic. And I think it surprises people when I tell them I am the biggest fan of the millennials and Gen Z that you'll ever meet. And part of this is, I love this kind of narrative about the millennials that they're entitled and they're soft and they're little snowflakes. Then I tell you, you've never seen them in a firefight in Afghanistan. Or you've never seen him as a firefighter here in California, or a teacher, or a doctor. This is a fabulous group of Americans, and I am convinced when they write the history of the 21st century, they will say that this was the greatest generation, these millennials. So I think when we, again, they're different than the baby boomers were, but in a good way. You know, they are more inclusive. They ask hard questions. They really take care of their friends. And whether you agree with their politics or not, you know, you look at what the kids in Parkland did as they mobilized against an issue they thought was important. I'm not sure my generation would have done that. So I think that there is hope because the young men and women give us hope.
Thank you. Nick?
I'm optimistic. We've got a great country. You just, in this conversation, we are powerful. We can do great things in the world. We've got enormous challenges. Climate change is the biggest. Dealing with Chinese power, pushing out against us in the Pacific is another, containing Putin. Dealing with our problems here at home, like inequality, is going to be very important. But as long as we've got good leadership, good women, good men coming into public office and leading us forward, our country can do great things, so I am optimistic.
John?
Optimistic. Our strength is who we are. We're going through a process here right now, and it's temporary, it will be temporary, to where we're not getting along very well. We're not listening to each other. We're yelling at each other. There was a time not so long ago, and I'm very confident, very close in the future, to where we can have discussions about social issues or political issues and not hate each other. But we got to get beyond it, because no one, certainly Washington, is exceptionally dysfunctional because they can't talk to each other. Yeah. The good news is about people, most people, all they want to do is live their lives. They want to raise their families, get a halfway decent job, spend a little time watching the Boston Red Sox when they can. We are strong, and I am optimistic.
If you have any questions about being optimistic, I ask you to listen to these three individuals, because every one of them is a great public servant. And thank God that there are those who devote themselves to making our democracy strong for the future. This is our strength for the future. Thank you all. Good night.